I'm not a barefoot guy. I have the ugliest, nastiest feet, but they're also sensitive. Kind-hearted, kind-souled. Get it? Diz Runs Radio, episode 420 starts in 3, 2. Welcome back to Diz Runs Radio, where I talk with runners from all corners of the running world about running, life, and everything in between. I'm your host, Denny Cray, and it's just about time to head out the door for an easy run and a great conversation. So if you're ready, then I'm ready. Let's get started. Hey guys, so it's that time again. It is the end of the month, and that means it's time for the monthly listener question and answer, the listener Q&A episode of the show. If you're new to these parts, it's real simple. Each and every month, the last either Monday or Wednesday of the month, I dedicate an entire episode to simply answering your questions. I kind of collect some questions over the course of the month. And if you want to get your questions in next month, the best way to make sure that they get on the list is to head over to our Facebook group, which you can find if you just go to dizruns.com/Facebook, or if you're just, next time you're on the Facebooks, just type in the search bar, Diz Runs, and you'll see two things that pop up. One will be the page, and one will be the group. You're welcome to like the page. It's always cool, but definitely join the group. Click to join. You'll get allowed in. You'll be permitted access. Don't worry about that. But come on in and join the group and look around. There's lots of stuff. There's lots of fun communication, fun conversations happening every day. Jump right in. But then somewhere around the middle of the month, if I'm on top of my game, it'll be right at the 15th. If I'm slacking a little bit, it might be closer to the 20th. But somewhere in the middle of the month, I'll post up a photo that is a Q&A type of photo, and just basically say, what are your questions this month? And then you just put your questions into the comments. And then for this episode, I just fly through those comments, answering the questions as we go. And hopefully it helps. I will admit that sometimes I get stumped a little bit, but that's just part of the fun. So this month we've got, about 10 questions, something like that. So we got enough to certainly have a good little episode today. And thank you to everybody who went ahead and left a question this month. Hopefully my answers will be of some service as we go. So without any further ado, let's go ahead and dive in to the questions. So the first question comes from our resident hillbilly, Mr. Stephen Lee from Missouri, and one of the now three hosts of the Heartland Running Podcast. If you haven't been listening to that show before, make sure you check that one out. About a weekly show. What's it come out? Maybe Thursday, Friday, something like that, about every week. So definitely check it out. Good times. And you don't have to be just in the Heartland to enjoy the show. They have a lot of different races that they talk about and different products and things like that. So you can, even if it's not, you're part of the country, you're part of the world, there's still plenty of things to learn, and it's a good fun show. So make sure you check that out. Heartland Running, on whatever device you happen to listen to, or different, podcast app that you prefer. But anyway, enough plugging of Stephen and Andy and Christina's show. Let's get to Stephen's question. He says, any tips for staying sane while going around a half mile horse track for 10 hours? That, and why aren't you joining in? So, again, if you haven't listened to Stephen's show, or Stephen, again, and Andy and Christina's show, all three of them, all of the Heartland Running podcast hosts, will be participating in the Running Under the Stars race in Kentucky. It's not Lexington. Is it Paducah? I don't know. Somewhere in Kentucky. The start of June. It's a 10-hour race around a half-mile horse track. Run as far as you can in those 10 hours, and it starts, around nighttime and runs through the night. So why aren't I joining in? I think that pretty much sums it up. but in all seriousness, I think it'd be a fun race. Something I would enjoy doing. It's just, kind of logistics right now with that much travel and where we are financially. It's just, it isn't really feasible this year, but hopefully in the not too distant future, hopefully by the end of this year and certainly into 2018, there will be some more traveling, some more racing in different locations for me. And hopefully that'll result in a chance to connect with a bunch of you guys on a regular basis, whether that's at races or just, you know, if I'm traveling and you happen to be in that area, we can meet up for a run or whatever. But you know, I'm certainly looking forward to having a chance to break some bread and share a drink and maybe have a cup of coffee or whatever the case might be with as many of y'all that listen to the show as possible. So for the first half of Steven's questions, any tips for staying sane while going around a half mile horse track for 10 hours? Yeah, I mean, don't do it. No, but more seriously, you know, in talking to folks that have done these type of races before, and Steven, I'm sure you remember several of those different types of conversations we've had with different folks that have done those, you know, the multiple loop courses over the course of, you know, certain several hours or whatever the case may be, 12 hours, 24 hours, whatever the different distances are. You know, the one thing that seems to stick out to me in those times I've had those chats with other runners is to just remember to stay present and to run the lap you're in and enjoy what you see. You know, if you're running the same half mile loop, you know, many, many, many times over the course of those 10 hours, you know, what a cool chance to kind of have your own personal time lapse story of what happened. So, you know, I remember somebody and oh gosh, who was it? It's been a while. This was a long time ago episode, but one of the suggestions was to notice something different every lap around the course. And I think she was running in that episode, and gosh, I'm kicking myself for not remembering who, but I guess after 400 plus of these things, I can be forgiven for an episode that was, you know, 250 or 300 episodes ago. But you know, she was running a desert course. It might have been Javelina. It might have been what is it? Run Rabbit Run, I think, is in the desert. But whatever it was, you know, notice something different every time through. So the way that the shadow hits something different, or the way that the stars are different, or the way the moon looks different throughout the night. You know, since you're running at night, your scope of vision is going to be a little bit less than if it was daylight, where you could really see horizons and you can see shadows and things like that. But just notice something different every time around the course, if you can. You know, pick out a location, pick out something that is maybe the most visible spot of the course, and just notice something every time you pass that little spot. And just see if it's different. See what changes over the course of those 10 hours. Another suggestion, which I think is probably very would make a lot of sense, be very obvious, is to, you know, talk to the different runners. Over the course of 10 hours, you're not going to be at the same pace as everyone, but those that are faster than you, those that are slower than you, there's certainly going to be plenty of times over the course of 10 hours that y'all are, you know, side by side for a little bit. So, you know, start a conversation with somebody earlier with several different folks over the course of the first hour of the race and see how many times you catch back up to them over the, you know, later parts of the race. Maybe challenge yourself to remember some names. You know, try to talk to 10 or 15 people before the start of the race. You get a mental picture of, you know, what they're wearing and try to figure out some of those mental games of, you know, all right, her name's Erin and she's got an emerald colored green shirt on, so that the E and the E kind of come together, and that's how you know the different memory tricks that there might be out there. But then try to remember her name 6 hours later when you see her on the course again. Hey, Erin, how you doing, type of thing. You know, and challenge yourself on that front. Give yourself a little mental game to play. But I mean, shoot, you know, you got no shortage of options, and take advantage of all of them, because 10 hours on the horse track in the dark would be considered maybe a little bit on the boring side. But again, it's a challenge that I would be up for, maybe looking forward to an opportunity to doing something like that in the future. Just not this year. But thanks for the invite, Stephen. Of course, you were trying to peer pressure me into coming up there. You know, obviously you have a record of success for me against peer pressure with getting me to run that ultra. So keep pressuring me, and it's not going to pay off this year, but one of these years, hopefully sooner rather than later, my friend, we're going to share some miles on a race course, whether it's a loop course, whether it's a point to point, whatever it might be. We're going to share some miles together, and I can't wait for that to happen. But thanks for the question as always, Stephen. So Jill comes in with a question. She says, how do I train for a race at altitude if I live at sea level? Or do I just have to take my lumps and do the best I can on race day? I mean, basically, yeah, that's what you're going to have to do, Jill. It's not going to be, you know, there's just no way that you can train for the altitude that you'll be racing at when you live here in Central Florida, at sea level, it's just not going to happen. They do have on the market, you can get these things. And if you want to get one, you're welcome to, but they have like masks that you can wear that, kind of make you look like Bane from Batman, but you put this mask on over, it covers your nose and your mouth while you're running, while you're working out, while you're doing whatever. And you can adjust how much oxygen or how much air, it lets flow through. So you're getting less oxygen with each breath. You're having to work harder to get the oxygen, into your lungs. And that can certainly help to simulate what it's going to be like when you're running it, whatever that race in Utah is, 10,000 feet or 12,000 feet, whatever it might be. Gosh, I don't know. Is it really that high? I can't remember what it is, but whatever it is, certainly much higher than it is here in Florida. So you can get a feel for that. But like the physiological changes that happen, that you create more hemoglobin, so you can transfer more oxygen in your blood. That's one of the reasons that people go and train it at elevation is to do that. That comes from 24/7 exposure to less oxygen. So in order to get those same benefits here using that type of mask system, like you'd literally have to wear that mask for 2 or 3 weeks in a row to see that elevation in the hemoglobin in your blood. So that's not going to work. I don't think you'd probably want to wear that mask 24/7 for a month before the race, but it would at least give you a feel for what your body's going to feel like, how you might have to slow down a little bit to be able to perform without just becoming super winded, immediately because you're trying to go at the same normal pace type of thing. But yeah, ultimately, I imagine it's probably going to come down to just doing the best you can on race day, knowing that you're going to have a good strategy going in, knowing that you're going to need to slow down a little bit, and just trying to do your best when you get out there and have fun. Of course, is always the biggest thing you can do on race day. But yeah, training for it is going to be tough, both from the altitude factor and just from the climbing factor. We just don't have the hills here to train for what you're going to have to get into. But we'll obviously do the best you can, and we'll let the cards lie where they may on race day. Julie has a great question. All great questions, but this one really stuck out to me as a fun question for me to get to answer today. Julie asks, what is the biggest mistake you see most runners make during marathon training, during the actual marathon itself, and while recovering from a marathon? So, first and foremost, I do want to stress that, just because if you feel like I'm calling you out, or if some of the things I'm saying sound like they resonate with you, don't feel bad, because these are again common things, things that I probably have done in the past / may still find myself doing once in a while. So I'm not being holier than thou. I'm guilty of many of these mistakes too. And also just remember that if you don't know beforehand, you can't know that you're doing something wrong when you don't know that it's wrong. And the only way to learn, the only way to get better is to, do something wrong and then learn from it. So if you're making these mistakes, or at least what I would consider to be mistakes, maybe you don't consider them to be mistakes, but if you're making if these mistakes sound familiar to you, no worries. Learn from them and try to maybe make some improvements going forward. So before the race, during the training itself, and this also, FYI, this applies to not just marathons, but half marathons, 10Ks, just running in general. I think these things apply, maybe some of the race specific things apply to when you're racing, but again, it can apply to any distance. But since Julie's question is the marathon, I'm going to keep saying marathon, but if marathon's not your distance here, whatever your distance is, and odds are these same mistakes will also still apply. So in marathon training, I think the biggest mistake that most runners make is they do their easy runs too fast. You've heard me talk several times about 80-20 running, and if you're new to the show, you can go back through the archives. I have talked about 80-20 running several times over the last couple of years. It's a book written by Matt Fitzgerald, and it talks all about how we should do about 80% of our runs at a really relatively easy pace, and about 20% of our runs should be really, really difficult, and we really shouldn't be in that middle ground very often. But most runners that don't know any better tend to be in that middle ground where it's not fast enough to really help you improve, but it's also not slow enough to be a recovery restorative type of movement. So I think that's in training, I think that's the problem is that most runners have, many runners have, is not being hard enough on their hard days and certainly not being easy enough on their easy days / their long run days. So really trying to figure out what the right paces are and dialing those, or what the right effort levels are. I think we focus too much on pace sometimes and not worry about, man, it feels really hard today. Well, that means slow down so that your effort is appropriate. Don't worry about what the watch says pace-wise. Worry about how hard you're feeling. Maybe have a heart rate monitor so you can see how hard your body's actually working and go in those right areas. So going easy on the easy days, that is, I think, the biggest mistake most runners make during the training for their marathon. During the marathon itself, I think the biggest mistake people make is not sticking to the plan. And this is especially true when things seem like they're going pretty well. And again, this is something that is especially true for me, something that I tend to struggle with. So, you know, you might have a plan. It could include strategic walk breaks. It could include a run walk. It could include going at a certain pace and trying to negative split it at the end. But whatever it is, whatever your plan is going into the race, stick with it. Stick with it. You know, the last marathon I ran over at in California, the Running with the Bears. Again, if you've been around a while, you heard this story back when I first ran the race almost a year ago. But it was way hotter than it was anticipated, and I think that really screwed me up. But my plan got the better of me too. My plan was to go fairly conservative till about 20 miles, and then really try to hammer it over those last 10 miles. I started hammering it too early. I started hammering it around mile 17. Why? Because I was feeling really good at 17 miles. Probably better than I've ever felt 17 miles into a marathon before. Things were going great. I was having a good time. The course was kind of sparse at that point. So I was also planning on not bringing out my headphones until mile 20, until I was ready to go. So I was going to, you know, just kind of keep it easy. And then after get to about mile 20, I'm going to drop the hammer and see what happens over the last 10K, how strong I can finish. Well, I was kind of bored. I was by myself. I'd you know, the group that I had kind of been running with, they had fallen off the pace a little bit. I hadn't really picked up the pace, but at mile 17, I'm kind of by myself on these mountain roads. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to put the music in right now and just kind of keep it easy for another 3 miles. And then I'll find myself pushing with 10K to go. And, sure enough, man, as soon as I put that music in my ears and got listening to things, my pace picked up. I was pushing harder than I should have been. I was singing. I was having a good time. And I ended up hitting the wall pretty hard around mile 22. And by mile 20, I knew I was in trouble. And again, I think part of it was heat, but also part of it was that I had a strategy. I made the choice to deviate from the strategy that was working very, very well for me at the time. And by not continuing to follow that plan, by not continuing to stick with the strategy I had outlined, I think that got me in trouble. So I think a lot of people do that when things are feeling good. They pick up the pace a little bit too much. They skip a walk break. They don't take a gel or a, you know, some type of fueling source, or they don't stop at a water station. And those types of things that don't seem like a big deal in the moment catch up to you 6, 8, 10 miles down the road over that last half of a marathon. So have a plan and stick to it. Is, I think, a mistake that a lot of people make during a race. And then at the end of the race or after race, post-race recovery, hands down, the biggest mistake that people make is they don't take enough recovery. I've said before, and in the book, whenever the book finally comes out, and for those of you that pre-ordered the book, you should have gotten an email from me on Monday that kind of gives you a status update on why it's not out yet and what we're waiting on, and give a little extra little bonus for you so you can start reading it now, a little digital copy. But my go-to advice for my clients, for myself, and like I said, what my strategy for the book for recovery is to wait till you're pain 3+3 to start running again. And a lot of people don't do this. So what do I mean? I mean, when you're 3 days post-race, or when you're pain-free post-race, means that however long it takes to where your quads aren't hurting anymore, your calves aren't hurting anymore, there's nothing that feels tighter than normal, nothing that hurts when you're going up steps, when you're going down steps, when you're sitting down on the toilet, which you know, a lot of us know that sometimes gets you after a race. You think you're feeling good, and then you go to sit down and you're like, "Woo, boy, my quads are still on fire a little bit." Getting up from the couch, whatever it might be, those aches and pains that stick around after a race, depending on the terrain, depending on your training, depending on how the race went, those aches and pains might be gone in 3-4 days, in a week. Might take 10 days, might take 2 weeks, might take more than that. But however long it takes for you to be pain-free, you take that long before you start running again, and then add 3 more days. And that way it just gives yourself just a little bit of extra time, a little bit to make sure that, all right, really I'm recovered, I'm fully recovered, and I'm ready to start going again. Now, to be clear, I don't mean that you don't do anything for that entire time till you're pain-free plus three. Just don't run. So give yourself a couple of days to recover and then, you know, do some yoga, do some walking, go for a hike, get on the bike, go swimming, do something. Just don't run. Just don't run. Give yourself a chance. Give your running muscles a break. Give your joints and your bones a little break. Give your mind a break from running. And once you're pain free plus three, then ease back into it. But I see too many folks, and some of these are local folks, that they'll run a race and run it hard, and 2 days later they're back out at the group for speed training, and it's like, dude, you got to give yourself a break. You got to allow your body to recover. And the thought is, the prevalent thought among a lot of runners is, if I'm not working, I'm getting slower. I'm losing my fitness. And you've got time. You know, you're better off to take a little bit of extra time after a race to recover than to push it right back in an effort to not lose 2% of your fitness and then get injured and be out for 6 weeks or 8 weeks and lose 70% of your fitness. Okay. So think about the risk reward when it comes to after a race, and take enough time to really recover. And again, I think for a rule of thumb, which, you know, I don't like one size fits all things. And that's why I don't say 2 weeks or 10 days or, you know, X number of days per this distance versus that distance. Whatever your distance is, wait till you're pain three, add three more days, and then you're good to go. Thanks for the question, Julie. I hope all that made sense. Andy's got a really good question. It's a little bit long, but just bear with me because it's a good one. He says, I've been seeing a sports therapist for some flexibility issues. I'm getting ready to start training for a fall marathon. And while my therapist has given me a stretching and a PT plan for improving and maintaining proper flexibility, he is not a runner, or is he educated in incorporating, you know, that stretching plan into marathon training? I need to include this stretching program into my weekly training. I assume I should avoid doing this on high intensity days, such as long run days and speed workout days. On the other days, where do I place these stretching workouts? Pre-run, post-run, rest days, or space some hours between running and then stretch later? Basically, when should I stretch more often while I'm training for this race? And he feels like I probably need to keep stretching, kind of make this a permanent part of my routine to help stay injury free and to continue to improve as he keeps getting older. So Andy, that is a great question. In many runners struggle with stretching. The runner that's talking to you right now, the runner that is in your earbuds at this moment, struggles with stretching regularly. So don't consider yourself alone. You are in great, great company with being a runner that doesn't stretch enough. That said, with what you're doing or here, you know, kind of in general, don't stretch. Never. Everybody hear this one. Don't ever stretch right before you run. That just doesn't work. It increases your risk for injury. It actually slows you down. It's going to make your workouts less effective. There's so many things wrong. I don't have enough time to really get into all the details here, but static stretching before a run, before a workout, before you do something, isn't a good idea. So use that time to do a dynamic warm up, to do maybe some squats, some jumping jacks, some lunges, an easy run, a real easy jog. Do some high knees, some butt kicks, whatever. All different types of things to get your body loosened up before you run. That's all a good warm up. Don't stretch beforehand. After the run, it doesn't matter what your run is. Easy run, short run, speed intervals, tempo run, hill repeats, whatever it might be. After your run, best time to stretch. Your muscles are warm. The blood's flowing. Stretch it out. Make that part of your cool down routine. If you're like me, and a lot of times you're doing your runs and then you get in the car and you're going to go home to get the day going, or you finish your run and you're ready to get back to work or whatever the case might be, and you don't make that stretching, post-run stretching, a priority, whenever else you can do it is right after the run is the best time, whenever you actually do it is the next best time. So I tend to try to make stretching in the evening a priority, kind of after Addison goes to bed and I'm sitting at the, we're sitting around watching a little TV or chatting or whatever, maybe try to sit down on the floor and do some stretching while I'm watching TV. But as often as you can stretch, that's when you're going to get the most benefits. So to kind of try to answer all or parts of your question, any day is a good day. Every day is a good day, to be quite honest. Stretching to make gains in your flexibility, to make gains in the mobility that you have, you got to do it repeatedly. That doesn't mean like repeatedly after each time you run. It means like repeatedly every single day. So if you think of your muscles as like a big, thick resistance band, elastic band, or something like that, you know, if it's a really thick, heavy duty band and you try to stretch it, it's really tight and it's hard to pull it apart. But if you only do that once every couple of weeks, it's never going to get any looser. It's always going to be real tight, real taut, real hard to move. But if you stretch that band a couple times a day, every single day, over the course of 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks, it may not be super, super flimsy, but it's going to become easier. It's going to become less tight. And your muscles and your tendons are the same way. So if you keep stretching them a little bit, and you don't even need to spend 20 minutes each time stretching, 5 minutes here, 3 minutes there. You're doing something at work where you can have a little step where you can put your foot up on it and kind of lean forward. So you're stretching your calf while you're on the telephone, or you know, while you're brushing your teeth, or figure out ways to mix it in. When you're in the shower, instead of bringing your knee up to your chest to try to wash your toes, keep those legs straight, bend down and wash your legs that way. And now you're stretching your hamstrings while you're in the shower. All these different ways you can incorporate stretching into your daily routine. Do that. Now, is it great to have a nice, 10 or 15 minute stretching routine that sounds like that's kind of what you got from your doctor? Sure. Do that regularly. Do that 3 times a week, 4 times a week, 7 times a week in the evening before bed, after your runs, whatever. But don't overlook those little opportunities to get a little stretch here, a little stretch there, stretching your quads, stretching your calves, stretching your hamstrings, stretching your hip flexors. All those little opportunities are going to pay off. All right. And again, just think of that band, a little stretch here, a little stretch there, a little stretch here, a little stretch there. It loosens up over time and your muscles are the same way. You're not going to see any dramatic changes in flexibility by just stretching once in a while. But if you're consistent, man, it's going to pay off. It's going to pay off. And, it's definitely going to help you feel better. You know, scientifically, great studies. There's nothing that relates to stretching being an injury reduction technique. You know, there's no clear correlation, but I'll tell you from experience, from both from my personal experience as a runner and my own flexibility issues, and from the sports medicine athletic training world, there's definitely a relationship between being extra tight and having injuries. So working on your flexibility is key. It's going to help you. It's going to help your performance. It's going to help you feel better. It's going to help you maintain running longer and continue to make gains over the years. Lots of good benefits for stretching. So keep at it. And I think that somewhere on the website, I've got a video or two about some stretching stuff too. So I'll try to throw those in the show notes, and see if you can't find that, there. And again, disruns.com/420, for everybody else, that may be looking for it. Andy, it sounds like you already have a routine that your doctor gave you. So you're probably good there. But definitely check out the show notes. If anybody that's looking for some simple suggestions for stretching, disruns.com/420, I'll make sure to have that link in there, and that'll link back to a video or something like that should hopefully have a demonstration of them as well. Great question, Andy, and hope that you stick with it because it can be frustrating, but man, it pays off. Edu has a question. He says, my question is, what is your recommendation for off-season training? Quote unquote, like runners have an off-season, for off-season training. He says, I'm in between races and won't start until September for a winter marathon. I don't want to lose my fitness, but I'm not sure how much I should be doing to get to the sweet spot of giving your body a break while still maintaining his fitness level. He says, I go to the gym 6 or 7 days a week, and right now I'm averaging 18 to 25 miles a week of running, and some days working out twice a day. So, what should he do to maintain his level of fitness? It's a great question, and it's something I think it's very admirable of you that you're looking to have a little off season. Cause I know a lot of folks, and again, myself probably included, would say, all right, I've built to here. I just finished my race, made sure to take enough time to recover. And now let's start getting back into it again. Start trying to improve and improve my fitness. But I love the idea of taking a little bit of a downtime, taking a little bit of an off season, and just allowing some of those muscle imbalances that happen, that are natural, that are almost unavoidable for us as runners, allow some of those to correct themselves. So going to the gym, I think, is great. You're already doing that. Hopefully that means that you're doing some strength training in there. Strength training is great to balance things out and to keep you all around fit. I remember the conversation with Brogan Graham, the November Project founder. I don't know which number that was offhand, but it was a while back in the archives. He talked about how the best athletes make the best runners. So it's not just running straight all the time. It's about being able to move and having some strength and some flexibility and all those types of things. So doing those things at the gym, that's great. Keep that up. You know, I would say probably want to keep some base level of miles. Maybe it's, you know, 15 to 20 miles a week, something like that. Maybe closer to 20, just to keep that base built. Don't let the base erode, because you got to have a strong base to build your fitness back up in that next training cycle. But I think a couple of things that you could do that would really help would be to maybe do, you know, a little bit more focus on some other cross training. So some cycling, some swimming, some hiking, some things like that, that's going to work you, but it's not working the same muscles and the same way as running. So if that's already not part of your routine, yeah, I'd maybe sacrifice a run to do a cross training workout, or maybe two runs for two cross training workouts at some point during the summer months. Another thing you can do is maybe join up with a rec basketball league. If there's something at the gym, a basketball league, or play some tennis, or do something, some type of sport that is, you know, still running, but it's not running. It's still a workout, but it's not the same type of thing. You're doing some lateral movements. You're doing some faster stuff, some starts and stops and things of that nature, which again helps you to become a better athlete, which is going to play into helping you be a better runner this fall when you start training for that winter race. You know, maybe do some yoga. If you haven't done yoga before, mix some yoga in there instead of a workout. Mix some Pilates in instead of a workout to build some core strength and some stability and improve your flexibility. You know, all those things. Really, the world really is your oyster. There's no wrong answer. You know, you could even take a couple of weeks off of running and just don't run at all. Sure, that's going to impact your fitness a little bit, but as long as it's just a couple of weeks to do some other things, to have some fun, to relax, to try out a different type of workout, it's not going to hurt you. And it'll come back pretty quickly as long as it's, like I said, just a couple of weeks, and you get back into that normal, you know, 15 to 20 mile range. When you come back and ease back into it, you'll be fine. So you've got a lot of different options. There's no, you know, as per usual with me, there's no one size fits all. I think the biggest thing is, what do you enjoy? What do you enjoy? And do that. You know, maybe that's just run sprints. And just do a couple days of sprint work and do some kettlebell type of stuff. Maybe try out a CrossFit gym. You know, there's so many different options. So whatever you like to do, stay active, enjoy yourself, have fun, be outside, get on the trails. If you don't run trails very often, go out and run the trails. That's a different workout. You know, if you've never run the trails before, you go out and run a trail, you'll know you're working differently. You're not going to run as fast, which is going to be a great kind of off-season thing, a slower pace, softer terrain with the you know, ground of a trail versus the pavement of the roads. You know, that might be a good option. So there's so many different options, but whatever you do, just make sure it's fun. Make sure you're enjoying yourself. And the fitness benefits will come. Play with your kids. There's another good one. Go out and chase the kids around. You know, if you have kids, that's an option too. So, whatever it is, have fun, stay active, and you know, when you're ready to start, you know, maybe a month or so before training actually starts for your race, that's when you really want to kind of start going, not all in on just running, but really start to get back to where, you know, where you are now, where you're at 20, 25, maybe 30 miles a week of consistent running for the 4 to 6 weeks before the training actually starts. That way your base is good and solid, and you're ready to go from day one of your training to work up towards that marathon. So, great question, Adu, and thank you. John, our resident visual impaired runner from the Atlanta area, again, another past guest of the show, and again, I don't have my number chart in front of me, 100 something, I think, 180s maybe, but John asked, what are your go-to ultras and why? Tough question. You know, I mean, you all know that I'm an ultra ambassador. Love the shoes. They work very, very well for me. And I'm a big fan. You all know that. That said, if I had to pick just one style of ultras to wear, that'd be a tough one. I think I would probably go with the ones. They're a really lightweight shoe. They feel more like you're wearing a thick sock than like you're wearing a shoe, but the sole of the shoe is fully cushioned and fully protected your foot when you're running, which I like. They're super comfortable. So if I had to pick just one shoe, I think that would be it. I don't know that I'd call them my go-tos. What I wear it varies depending on where I'm running. What I'm running. Am I doing a speed workout? I'm going with the ones. Am I doing a longer workout? I might wear the Intuitions, which has a little bit more cushioning to it. I might wear the ones. Am I hitting the trails? And I'm wearing either the Superiors or the Lone Peaks. You know, I don't like the real cushiony options, so I don't have any of the more cushioned shoes. But if you like those, if you're kind of a Hoka type of person, they have some more cushioned options you can get into. So yeah, to say what is my one go-to style, whew, that's a tough one. So I think if I had to pick, it would be the ones followed by the Intuitions, because you can wear those road shoes. You can wear them on the trails if you need to, if you want to. They last, they hold up well. I've got hundreds of miles on all of my ultras, so I love that about them. So, you know, you really can't go wrong. You really can't go wrong. And I'll give a plug for disruns.com/ultra if you're in the market for some shoes that supports the show a little bit. And also right now, this is a good time of year to buy some shoes because the new models are out, so you can get the fresh new stuff. Or you can get the older stuff from last year that's still really, really just as good, to be quite honest, for about 60% off or so. Lots of things are marked down right now. So disruns.com/ultra if you want to shop a little bit and get yourself a couple pairs of shoes for a little bit cheaper price than what will be available in just a few months, because those markdown shoes will sell out quick, and then it's just the new stuff that's available at full price. Edu has another question. One more. He says, what was your take on the 2-hour marathon attempt? All right. I'll be honest here. And this may not be the most popular answer, but I was kind of meh about the whole thing. And allow me to explain that. First of all, the idea of running a marathon in 2 hours is mind blowing to me. And the fact that these guys came this close, I mean, what was it, 24 seconds or 26 seconds or something like that off, basically 1 second per mile faster, and he would have gotten it, you know, it's mind-blowing. It's stupid fast. It's faster than I can run 1 mile. These guys hammered out 26 of them, okay? So it's not that I was meh about it because I didn't care. It wasn't impressive. It was crazy impressive. But the reason I was kind of eh about the whole thing is it just seemed very, very manufactured to me. Way more manufactured than Roger Bannister breaking the 4-minute mile. It was, let's see if we can get special fancy shoes, special fancy clothes, the most optimal, perfect diet, and just try to almost kind of felt test tube, lab controlled to me. Where I'll be super impressed, where I'll lose my mind, is when it happens in a race. When somebody shows up at a race, probably Berlin, because that seems to be like the fastest of the major marathons where the truly elites show up. Somebody shows up at Berlin and throws down a 1:59 point. It'll be crazy. It will be crazy. I'll lose my mind then. I expect that that's going to happen. I expect that that's going to happen within my lifetime, probably within the next couple of decades. Somebody at a race is going to throw down a sub-2. Before that, I think it'll probably happen in another of these type of things, whether Nike does it or whether somebody else sponsors it and puts it together. I think these guys will do it, and who knows? It may be one of the guys that ran it just now and came up just short. And it'll be impressive. It'll be cool. But again, it'll be too contrived for me to really get excited about it, to really care about it. I didn't watch any of it. I only knew that it had happened. I mean, I knew that it was coming, but I didn't know when it was happening. And then I kind of found out like the next day on Twitter, I saw all the stuff about it, and I was like, oh, I guess the thing must have been last night. I just wasn't into it. It was too contrived for me, for my taste, to really care that much. And again, that's to take nothing away from the guys that were doing it, nothing away from how incredible that performance was, their performances all were. I just can't wait to see it on a race course, on an official race day. I don't care if they have rabbits to chase. I don't care if they have people helping to pace them. None of that matters. I just don't want it to be like a, hey, we're gonna manufacture it ourselves on a closed course on this day, blah, blah, blah. Like, I want it to be, I'm running Berlin, my goal is sub-2, and freaking does it. And I will lose my mind. But great, great question. I do. Thank you. And I'd love to know, love to know from everybody. What was your take on it? Hit the show notes, disruns.com/420 and leave a comment there. Ed's got a couple of questions. First question, pretty hot here in the UK today. He says it was 27 degrees Celsius, which is about 80 degrees Fahrenheit. What is your ideal weather conditions for a marathon? So me personally, what I like is, I gave two answers in the write-up today on the show notes for this episode. So my ideal would be like mid-50s. You know, kind of a overcast day where the temperature doesn't really go up very much, pretty much stays, you know, mid 50s, maybe hits the low 60s as the high at some point during the race. You know, just kind of a cool-ish day, not cold, not really cool, but certainly not hot. You know, I don't like being cold, especially at the start of a race. So if I wanted to be a little bit more cheeky in my answer, and since we're saying what's my ideal weather conditions, I'll give you my ideal, Ed. My ideal is that before the race, it's about 75, 80 degrees Fahrenheit. So whatever that works out to be, I guess about the same as it was in the UK when you were asking this question, about 27 degrees Celsius, 25, 27 degrees Celsius. That's what I want it to be before the race starts. At about an hour, maybe 30 minutes before the race starts, I want a noticeable cold front to start moving through, and I want that temperature to drop from 75 or 80 Fahrenheit to maybe low to mid 60s. So I don't know exactly where that would be. Maybe 12 to 18 degrees, somewhere in there of Celsius. Definitely noticeably cooler, but still not cold. And I want that to be where it starts the race. And then over the first hour or so of the race, I want that temperature to continue to drop down to the low 50s. Which is about where you know, realistically I would like it. But my ideal race would be start hot and keep getting cooler. That would be perfect for me, which I don't know. I guess that means we have to start the race in the evening and have it go into the night type of thing. So maybe Steven running under the sun, or under the stars, will see this happen for him. But that would be my ideal situation. Now, scientifically, they say the ideal is about a 41 degree, I believe, 41 degree Fahrenheit, 5 degrees Celsius start time temperature. It's cool, but it's not, you know, it's not so cold that your body can't warm up fairly quickly. It's certainly not hot enough that the heat is going to impact your race. So that's what they say is ideal. For me, I want it a little bit warmer than that. But that's just me. And maybe that would impact my performance a little bit. Maybe I wouldn't get quite the best race day effort. But I'd rather be comfortable at the start of the race. Not over hot, not overheated, but just comfortable. Mid-50s, you know, probably about, like I said, about 17, 18 degrees Celsius. I didn't check that one out, though, so you have to maybe throw that into Google for me. But I think that's where my pace or my preferred weather would be. Ed's second question. We got two questions left, one from Ed and one from Jessica. Ed's question, the second one, is, I've had runner's knee flare up after 2 months of pain-free running. I'm thinking to rest and just stop running for 2 weeks, but still cross-train and then resume at half my previous distance and mileage and build up back up from there. Does this sound in the right ballpark? Yes, it does, Ed, but... Yes, it sounds right, but... So for a couple of things I want to make sure we're clear on first. First of all, runner's knee. Want to make sure that that's kind of that pain on the outside of your knee, kind of grinding at the kneecap, which is commonly associated with iliotibial band syndrome, ITB, or IT issues, where the IT band is tight and it's pulling on your kneecap, and that's where the pain comes, is in your knee. So that's where I'm taking it, or where I'm assuming you're talking about runner's knee. So I want to make sure that we're both talking about the same thing. Then the next thing I want to say is, you know, you said you had 2 months of pain-free running. Does that mean that 2 months ago you were having some runner's knee issues and now it's been 2 months pain-free and now the runner's knee issues are back? If that's the case, and that's kind of how I took it, may not be the case for you, but I think this will still help answer your question. I think your strategy is great. I think that's a good idea. Do some other training, some other cross-training type of things to maintain your fitness and then ease back into running. All perfect suggestions. But my question is, what are you doing to address the cause of your runner's knee? And this is for anybody. If you're dealing with runner's knee and you're like, oh, that's a great suggestion that Ed had and Diz seems to agree with it, so let's do it. What are you going to do to make sure it doesn't come back again? What are you going to make sure that 2 months from now you're not having the same problem? So if you're unaware with the definition of runner's knee that we just gave, so it's kind of a tight IT band where it's pulling on your knee, a lot of times, like 9 times out of 10, that is a symptom of a weak core, an unstable core. So make sure you're doing plenty of core strengthening and stability in those 2 weeks when you're not running. And then also once you get back to running, do some planks, do some bridges, do some side planks are great. Crunches, things like that, hip extensions, all those types of things, those are good. But your real stability strengthening exercises, planks, bridges, side planks, stability type of things on the stability ball where you're doing some sitting there and maybe lifting a leg up. So you have to, it sounds awkward and it is kind of awkward, but it's great stability things for your trunk, your core. So make sure you're doing those things to build your core strength. Another issue that sometimes crops up with IT band issues is a weak vastus medialis, the inner part of your thigh, your thigh musculature is weak. It's a hard thing to target with strengthening. And I posted a video in the show notes for this episode that is by far, it was the video I was going to make until I saw it. And I was like, I don't need to do a VMO strengthening video because this one's perfect. Some exercises you can do to really target that area of your legs to make sure that those muscles are strong, which helps to pull your kneecap the other direction. So you might have a slightly tight IT band, but if you contradict it with an equal and opposite force pulling the other way by strengthening your inner thighs, you're not going to have a problem. So make sure you're strengthening your inner thighs. Again, dizruns.com 420 has the link to that video. It's about a 4 or 5 minute video. It's great. Work on your core strengthening, core stability, and maybe get some foam rolling on your outer thighs as well, on your IT band to help relieve those symptoms. I think that what your plan is, Ed, spot on. Just make sure that you're doing some things once you get back to running again so that you're not dealing with this problem again in the future, because whatever weak link has caused the runner's knee to flare up, odds are, if you don't address it, it's going to cause it to flare up again once you get back into running. It doesn't matter how slow you build up, that weak link is always going to be there. And once you get to a certain point, which is probably about the point where you are when it started to flare up again or flare up previously, it's going to flare up again. So address that weak link. And again, guys, that is runner's knee, that is shin splints, that is plantar fasciitis, that is... those are probably the big three, but those are the types of things that you can definitely work to avoid by just doing the right things. And if you're not sure what to do, let me know. Those are my go-to. Those are my bread and butter type of things to solve. And I can help you solve them very, very easily if you're dealing with those things over and over and over again. So the last question comes from Jessica. I need a sip of coffee before we hit this one. All right. Jessica says she's just getting back into running after a foot injury sidelined her for 6 weeks. And she's coming to terms with the fact that wearing cheap flip flops is not doing my feet any favors. What shoes/sandals do you recommend for runners when they're not in their running shoes? And please don't just say none. She says I'm a former barefoot and flip flop girl. Don't worry, Jessica. I'm not going to tell you to not wear sandals or flip flops because, I literally wear sandals 365 days a year. I wear my rainbows, which some people would call them flip-flops. I call them sandals, tomato, tomato. But I wear my rainbows every single day. Probably the last time I didn't wear my rainbows was almost 3 years ago when I was in Michigan at Thanksgiving time and there was some snow. I think I wore shoes most of those days. So probably not rainbows then. Every day since then, for going on, you know, at this point, 2.5 years, I've worn my flip flops. So you can definitely do it with, you know, without tearing up your feet. And again, to kind of piggyback off of the answer from Ed's question, the last one, I think at this point, you know, after your injury, which I think you mentioned maybe to me in a private message, there was some surgery involved too. But after this injury, you need to look at maybe at supporting it. So get some good shoes now. So get something that has some support. If you're going with sandals, there's lots of different options out there. I know you'd put a post, you know, independent of this question in the group. And there were some people that gave some great suggestions. A quick Google has a lot of different orthotic type of options. The only one that I have experience with are Spenco sandals. My mother-in-law used to work at a podiatrist office and we went for about 2 years where like at Christmas and birthdays and anytime and every time that there was any type of gift giving holiday, we'd get a new pair of sandals and some insoles and some things like that. And they were all Spenco. And the Spenco sandals, like, I don't really like them. They're not as comfortable to me, but probably because they are more supportive. But you know, they have a good solid rigid, footbed, a good arch, good support. And they're, you know, you can get flip-flop sandals, you can get thong sandals, whatever you want to call them. You can get regular slide-on sandals, some that are fancier, some that are more casual. So you got a lot of options there. And there's dozens of other companies that make similar types of products. But my recommendation to you would be what can you start doing now that you can continue to do for the next 6, 8 weeks, months, whatever down the road to really build up the strength in your feet so that you can get away with wearing some cheap things once in a while. So you can get away with going barefoot once in a while. I'm not a barefoot guy. I have the ugliest, nastiest feet, but they're also sensitive. They're also sensitive, kind-hearted, kind-souled. Get it? But you know, like I, it hurts me to sometimes walk on the grass with bare feet. So I always have to have shoes on, but my shoes are always my sandals. But what I'm trying to say here is you can do some things to help strengthen your feet so that you can get away with being barefoot. You can get away with wearing some cheapo sandals once in a while. So you can get away with wearing some rainbows or something that's a little bit fancier, a little bit nicer, but doesn't have that type of support to them. And if you're not sure what to do, again, there's a video I did a while back, and I got the link in the show notes for today, dizruns.com/420, that shows you some simple things you can do to strengthen your feet. Walking on your tiptoes, walking on your heels, picking up like marbles or game pieces or little things with your toes, doing towel crunches. There's a bunch of things you can do that all strengthen your feet, which then allows the muscles in your feet to do the support that they're designed to do. So you don't need an arch to do it. You don't need a supportive shoe to do it. They're going to do it. You just need to build that up slowly. You know, when I first started wearing sandals all the time, I couldn't wear my sandals all day every day because my feet couldn't handle it. Now, doesn't matter. I walk around Disney for 12 hours with my flip-flops on. Feet feel fantastic. You know, it doesn't matter. Like my feet are going to be fine with unsupportive shoes because the muscles in my feet are so strong. They have such good endurance that they can handle me being on my feet all day. Just take some time to build that. So get started with, you know, get some Spenco sandals, get something that has a decent arch, a decent support in it. Ask your doctor for recommendations. They probably have a company that they could recommend you to. Again, check out your post, which I'm sure you already did, that has a bunch of different options that I think there were five or six different people that had responded that had some different options for you. Google, you know, I Googled and found a bunch of different options, to give you that support now, that protection now, and then keep working towards it. And it, you know, 6 months down the road, maybe next year, next summer, by that point, if you're consistent with it, it won't matter. You can get the cute stuff and the things that don't have much support, you can go barefoot and you'll be good to go. What I would caution against, don't wear things with pointed toes. Don't wear heels. Those ruin your feet more than anything else. So I know that tends to single out the ladies. But again, pointed toe type of things, dress your shoes with pointed toes, and anything with a heel, not good for you. Not good for you. So try to stay away from those. Whew. And that's it. That's it for today. This is a good Q&A episode. I managed to ramble long enough to make this thing, you know, getting close to an hour. I'm not going to ramble on long enough to get it to the full hour, but we managed to cover some ground today. So hope that these questions helped. Hope that these answers helped, I guess, more than I hope that the questions helped. But for those that asked the questions, thank you. Without you guys asking these questions, we don't have this episode every month. And I know that there's other folks that are struggling with these same types of questions that y'all have. So thank you guys for putting yourselves out there, for being willing to offer some questions. And hope that my answers helped you. And don't forget that if you want to get your questions answered next month, head to the Facebook group, dizruns.com/Facebook. Join the group. I'm posting stuff in there just about every day. We have a lot of fun, lots of memes, lots of jokes and laughs, and there's some videos and all kinds of stuff. Join in the party. Join in the group. Don't be just a lurker. Come in, hang out, have fun with us. And then once you see that post that says, hey, the Q&A episode's coming up, throw your questions in the comments. Throw your questions in the comments. It's pretty simple. And then I'll get your questions answered next month. And hopefully that'll help you and help others along the way as well. So that's it for today, guys. Thank you so much for listening. As always, hope you have a great rest of the day. And definitely looking forward to talking to you again soon. So until next time, take care of yourselves. And we'll talk soon. Take care, guys.